The Sunstone Foundation presents Not Commanded in All Things, Alternate Voices in the Church, Part 1. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
Again in August, except in 1831, 158 years ago, a year and a half after the organization of the church, Joseph Smith counseled Edward Partridge, the Colesville Saints, and others who had recently gathered in Jackson County to build Zion, that Latter-day Saints should not be commanded in all things. In that revelation, now section 58 in the LDS Doctrine and Covenants, the prophet said that as agents with power inherent in themselves, the saints should counsel between themselves and God and do many things on their own to accomplish good. Nevertheless, 2 years earlier, in 1829, even before the church was established, the inherent tension between organizational concerns and independent individual action was already evident when in Revelation, Joseph instructed his brother Hiram to not suppose that you are called to preach until you are called. Since those founding years, the restored kingdom has been built both by the inspired directions of leaders and countless independent, selfless actions of members. Looking back, many past actions, probably most, were valued by the church. Some were even incorporated as programs. Yet there are famous examples where a person's opinions or actions were at the time not viewed by leaders and many in the community as being helpful. Sometimes they were considered as inappropriate dissent, and other times they were considered heretical, yet only years later to be adopted by later generations as approved doctrine or procedure. Recently, the nature and function of independent action was addressed in several talks in the April 1989 General Conference, beginning with President Benson's keynote address on pride, in which he discussed, among other things, the pride of intellectuals. Apostle Dallin Oaks distinguished between the official voices of the church, which he said are refined by a spiritual quality control review process. And he distinguished between the official voices and what he called alternate voices, those who speak and write on church topics without calling or authority. He stated that the church does not attempt to isolate its members from alternate voices, but with a pastoral concern, he warned that some alternate voices pursue selfish, personal interests, including property, pride, prominence, and power, and they devour the flock. He counseled members, especially leaders, to choose wisely in their participation in independent voices and to avoid any implication of church endorsement. Finally, as Joseph had earlier counseled, Elder Oaks told the saints to turn to God for revelation and said that reasoning and scholarship are but means to revelations and are not ends in themselves, and that the critic too often yields to the persuasions of men. Just preceding Elder Oaks, Bishop Glenn Pace warned that critics within the church often engage in inappropriate intellectualism, the nailing down of every intellectual loose end rather than accepting the witness of the Spirit and getting on with it, he said. Inappropriate intellectualism leads one to testify that he knows the gospel is true, but the brethren are just a little out of touch, close quote. He testified that his experience was that the brethren are not naive to the major issues and trends of society, and he pleaded with saints to follow the living prophets instead of the dead. Later in the conference, Apostle Russell Nelson lamented the canker of contention and said that dissecting doctrine in a controversial way in order to draw attention to oneself is not pleasing to the Lord. Certainly no faithful follower of God, he said, would promote any cause, even remotely related to religion, if it is rooted in controversy, because contention is not of the Lord. Surely a stalwart would not lend his or her good name to periodicals, programs, or forums that feature offenders who do so discord among the brethren, he said. As we begin 3 days of exploring the restored gospel, it is good that we discuss the function of alternate voices within the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. There are quite a few sessions that will discuss that in this conference. We have invited four people who have somewhat different perspectives to share their views tonight. In this order, they will present them. Levina Fielding Anderson will go first. Levina has a breadth of experience. She served as an assistant editor in the Ensign, associate editor, both.
Queen.
She also served as an associate editor for Dialogue, so she's been on both sides of the fence. She's written and edited many of the, commentaries that have been published in Dialogue and Sunstone, and she has edited many more. She currently is president of Editing Incorporated. Levina will be followed by Lynn Packer. Lynn is a journalist who believes in an open and honest, forthright presentation of facts. He teaches journalism at BYU. He used to be a journalist for KSL, teaches both broadcast and print journalism. He's a freelance journalist, and he has published several cover stories for Utah Holiday. Lynn will be followed by Marie Cornwall. Marie has a PhD in sociology, with an emphasis in the sociology of religion. She is an assistant professor of sociology at Brigham Young University. And before that, she worked for the church in some of their top secret research projects in studying the membership of the church. She has a vivid interest in building community and studying how religious communities function and how they function well and how they function poorly. Finally, Marie will be followed by Orson Scott Card. Scott also was at the Ensign at the same time Levina was. Isn't that right?
She still has the scars, so do I.
All right. Scott, I think, is known to many for his award-winning publications in the science fiction field, including Ender's Game and Speaker for the Dead. He's also published extensively in the Mormon field. His novel Saints is one example where he has explored in a fictional context some of the issues of the early church in its pioneer days concerning women. He is an early writer in many of the early issues of Sunstone magazine, and he has recently come on board again as a columnist, which I'm sure many of you have read. After Scott, we'll have a period where the panelists can make any additional comments they want after hearing what the other people say and can respond to them. We might have some questions among ourselves, which we'll discuss, and then we'll open the time to the audience if they have any questions. We should be out of here by around 10 o'clock, but we'll close first with another musical number by Elaine Thatcher. And so we'll turn the time over to our participants in that sequence.
I have here an 18-minute presentation. This is not because I was assigned to do the final word, but out of lack of information. Albert was supposed to tell me by the 1st of August what the format of the panel was, and when he didn't, I wrote my presentation and told him that it was too late last night to change it. So, they are entitled Remarks from an Alternate Voice. At the Mormon History Association annual meeting in Nauvoo in May, a friend who shall remain nameless at the suggestion of my husband who thought he might get fired, and I were strolling around the temple site. Among other topics, Elder Oaks's alternate voices address at the conference came up. I forget which one of us originated the hypothesis that this speech represented the triumph of the liberals in the Quorum of the Twelve and staked out a bold and daring position for moderation against the conservative faction. Then we laughed. It felt good to laugh then, and I recall that moment of laughter now for two reasons. I am not comfortable with the tensions involved in a public critique of an Apostles' Conference talk, although I think it's very important to make that critique. And second, we don't know the background of the talk. We don't know if it represents a consensus position or an individual one. Above all, we do not know what Elder Oaks intended or how well he felt he succeeded. What I want to discuss are some implications of what the address said to me. I found three major implications disturbing. The marginalization of alternate voices within the church, the disenfranchisement of members as representatives of the church, and the elimination of sincere and edifying discussion in the continuum of discourse between the two poles of silent listening and contention. Let me supply a preface for my remarks. I found much in Elder Oak's talk that I could and do wholeheartedly support, and I have a footnote which I will read if anyone challenges me on that one. Nor do I question his right to say basically what he thinks right using General Conference as a forum. I respectfully suggest, however, that those public pronouncements are not immune from discussion and group consideration, that they inevitably enter into dialogue with other pronouncements and with our understandings. It is appropriate for us to be discussing them tonight. I also want to make it absolutely clear that although I hope I am not speaking either aggressively nor defensively, I am speaking as an alternative voice, or to use Leonard Arrington and Davis Bitten's term, which I prefer, I am speaking from the unsponsored sector. I looked over my vita the other day and noticed that I have been a member of the Mormon History Association for 16 years. In various positions as an officer in that organization, I have also contributed 16 years of service. I have been a member of the Association for Mormon Letters for 13 years and have, as an officer, contributed 6 years of service. I am a charter subscriber to Dialogue, Sunstone, and Exponent 2, along with half a dozen other Mormon periodicals that have come and gone in the last 2 decades. I've written for all three, participated in several Sunstone symposia, attended all that have been held in Utah, and a couple that have been held elsewhere, been associate editor of Dialogue for 5.5 years, and have participated in the B.H. Roberts Society and the Mormon Women's Forum. But I also currently hold 3 callings in my ward, and when I counted up the years of church service since my first calling as a primary teacher at age 14, it came to 61 years. I'm 44 right now. Or is it 45? I consider both forms of service, unsponsored and official, to be extremely important. My life would have been the poorer had I lacked either. However, Elder Oaks' address, by implication and by structure, marginalizes these unsponsored associations, which are precious to me, and stigmatizes them by suggesting that their purpose is to deceive. He lists 4 groups of alternate voices. 1, those of well-motivated men and women who are merely trying to serve their brothers and sisters and further the cause of Zion. I point out in passing how different the tone of this passage would have been if he had called them well-motivated men and women who are honestly or sincerely trying to serve, rather than men and women who are merely trying to serve. And since when was service something to be dismissed as mere in this church anyway? 2, those motivated by selfish personal interests. 3, those that are the bleatings of lost souls who cannot hear the voice of the shepherd. And 4, those whose avowed or secret object is to deceive and devour the flock. Although he acknowledges in the next paragraph that there have always been other alternate voices whose purpose or effect is unselfish and wholesome, the paragraph which follows describes but does not name magazines, journals, newspapers, lectures, symposia, and conferences. One of my friends observed, as long as he doesn't name names, he hasn't really said anything. I don't agree. I think that by not naming names, Elder Oaks has potentially created arrest warrants with the name of the offender left blank. These groups are accused and judged in absentia. Their exact crimes are left unspecified. They are given no witnesses to confront and no chance to defend themselves. Perhaps not by Elder Oaks, but by others who, uncomfortable with differences, now feel free to say, oh, he must be talking about, and then fill in the blank with the object of their suspicion or dislike. I have heard numerous reports of such occurrences since April, and I don't like it very much. I make no bones about saying that in criticizing this point of Elder Oaks' talk, I am protesting negative labeling for myself and for others like me. My second point is perhaps less personal, but more serious in its implication, the disfranchisement of members of the church as representatives of their church. I want to make it clear that I do not think anyone who calls himself or herself a Mormon has the right to make legally binding statements for the church, define doctrine, or stake out policy at random in an area where no policy has previously existed. And it is true that Elder Oaks describes a debate or a symposium as the context. However, this address creates, I believe, a more rigid definition of the term church leader. I have been accustomed to think of leadership in the church as a fluid and shifting category as people are called into and released from positions. As a primary teacher, I consider myself a leader of my class, while my own leaders are the primary presidency. There are many fewer women leaders than I would like to see, but I acknowledge and respect the authority of male and female teachers, executives, and counselors from the local level to the general. Elder Oaks, in his address, refers to general authorities as such only once, and then in reference only to himself, and to local church leaders only once, meaning stake and ward level. However, in four crucial and puzzling paragraphs about how the church's position may be established on a given issue, he refers to church leaders or representative of the church five times and to members or volunteers five times. And here is a summary of those four paragraphs. Church leaders are sometimes invited to state the church's position at a debate or symposium, but the church is directed to avoid disputation and contention. Moreover, if a representative of the church participated in such an event, this could have the unwanted effect of encouraging church members to look to the sponsors of alternate voices to bring them information on the positions of the church. Church leaders should avoid official involvement, directly or indirectly. And that seems to leave open the possibility of unofficial involvement, directly or indirectly, but I'm not quite sure how you would do that. Volunteers do not speak for the church. The church's silence does not constitute an admission of facts asserted in that setting. The structure of this argument clearly juxtaposes leaders and members. The term church leaders is usually an elastic one, but I think the meaning here is not. Leader in this context seems to mean exclusively general authority, a cultural and perhaps theological innovation of this address with which I am very uncomfortable. In this context, a young women's president or a missionary or that missionary's president or a stake president would not be a leader but a member. Thousands of LDS women would perhaps be surprised to learn that Barbara Smith's energetic defense of the church's anti-ERA position was not made as a church leader. In short, members are not leaders, and what is more troubling, leaders are not members. I am troubled by this image of a leadership that defines itself as different in kind from members, that sets itself sharply apart from members, that assigns members to be examples and missionaries for the church, denies that these volunteers acting on assignment do not represent the church, refuses to represent the church itself if it wishes, either to honestly questioning members or to outsiders interested in the church for whatever reasons, and then also insists that its silence does not count. If a friend treated me in such a way, I would not know which to deplore first: the naivety of thinking that refusing to converse is not a message, or the arrogance of claiming a relationship but refusing the demands inherent in a relationship. My third concern is the elimination of any middle ground in public discourse between disputation and contention on the one hand, and on the other, listening to the voice of the church with no need to be on guard against being misled. The address characterizes a debate or symposium about some doctrine, ordinance, or practice of the church, sponsored by the unofficial sector, as an adversarial clash of opposing viewpoints, as disputation and contention, as potentially containing mixtures of good and evil that a faithful Latter-day Saint would not wish to support or promote. The Lord's prescribed methods of acquiring sacred knowledge, he tells us, are very different from the methods used by those who acquire learning exclusively by study. Are all of the Lord's methods so very different? What of Doctrine and Covenants 88:118, which requires us to seek learning even by study and also by faith? Study further involves the intuitive activities of evaluating and organizing information and the cooperative activities of discussion. Are these activities totally disengaged from one's spiritual life and values? The address continues. A frequent technique of scholarship is debate or adversarial discussion. True, but frequent does not mean invariable. But the Lord has instructed us that we should not contend over the points of his doctrine. Also true, but is all discussion contention? is all conversation, dialogue, exchange, talk, examination, analysis, query, deliberation, conferring, consultation, and inquiry, contention. Gospel truths and testimony, continues the speaker, are received from the Holy Ghost through reverent personal study and quiet contemplation. That is only partially true, or we members have been sorely misled about some of the value of Sunday meetings with their thousands of hours of lessons if they contain no gospel truths and if they have no impact on our testimonies. My personal experience is that aspects of my testimony have also come and or been strengthened by well-prepared and well-presented public speeches in a variety of settings, ranging from BYU devotional addresses and Stake and General Conference to the B.H. Roberts Society and the Sunstone Symposium, by private conversations with people who have shared both deep doubts and deep convictions, by lessons that have provided a forum for discussing gospel questions with members of my ward or institute class, and even on occasion by a debate or an attack that has forced me to rethink a position or a commitment. I am dismayed by the omission of all of these sources of knowledge, and even more by the implication that searching for understanding cannot be a shared communal activity. Even Jesus Christ, the Good Shepherd for whose voice we listen, was not ashamed to say, "Come, let us reason together." Mormons already listen too much and too passively. A talk like this reinforces those who already feel guilty about their questions. It encourages them to suppress their questions and to attack or shun those who do voice their questions. This address also seems to suggest that faithful Mormons do not need to learn the techniques of asking questions that might lead them to personal enlightenment and productive dialogue with others. It further seems to suggest that Mormons, especially Mormon leaders, need not learn the techniques of listening to questions in ways that promote such dialogue. And it seems to place on those who are designated as leaders the burden of always speaking, and of always speaking infallibly, of being incapable of being misled themselves or of misleading others. I do not believe that any mortal can bear such a burden. I agree wholeheartedly with Elder Oaks that we must all learn to recognize the voice of the Good Shepherd. The distinction between sheep and shepherd is one that I accept. But as a sheep, I want to listen for the voice of the shepherd myself. When the voice seems confusing or profound beyond my depth, I want to search for clarity. The opinions of my fellow sheep may be more or less valuable, but they are still opinions. Not one of them, nor any group of them, is the shepherd himself. They are, in fact, alternate voices to his divine voice. Perhaps I am responding too strongly to my own sensitivities in describing what I see as a dangerous tendency toward dichotomies in the church, a dichotomy that leads us away from community, toward a system of leaders who are not members and of speakers who are not listeners, of hierarchs who separate themselves from their underlings. Such a system may have the bureaucratic advantage of efficiency as it promotes conformity, obedience, and passivity. But this is not a description of a nation of kings and priests, queens and priestesses, of a people free in the liberty wherewith Christ hath made us free, or of a church in which every man and every woman may speak in the name of God. Thank you.
I am not an alternate voice. Journalists are not alternate voices per se, but we're conduits for alternate voices, official voices, information from various sources. The role of a journalist is to gather information, alternate voices among them. Usually the news media are neither the originator, the message, nor the original messenger. In America and in the world, we're getting a greater division of labor, and so now often you don't get the message directly from the messenger, but you get it somewhere from the news media, among others. Sometimes you get it directly such in a forum such as this.
But the mass news media, newspapers, news magazines, television newscasts, mostly collect and transmit information. The media help create a marketplace for ideas. And there are those, of course, who are opposed to a free marketplace of ideas. They're opposed to a free flow of information. Some of them would only like to see official voices being used. And when I talk about official voices, I'm not confining it to religion, although that certainly is included. But we're talking also about government, about politics, about business, private institutions, and society in general. Over the years, it's been my experience and my observation, and it's something that I've spoken about on occasion in quite a bit of detail. Church authorities, LDS church authorities, the high church leaders, are generally anti-news media. I think sometimes that's based on misunderstanding. They don't exactly understand what the role of journalism is. Probably more often, though, it's just a disagreement with the role of what journalists are trying to do. And here's how many church leaders see journalists. Picture a lifeboat full of people flooding with water. Church leaders see themselves bailing out the water and directing the boat to safety. They see journalists who are along for the ride busy dumping water back in and disrupting their leadership. I agree that, and journalists recognize this, that in the short run, in the short haul, many times news stories, whether they're from alternative or official voices, can be destructive. But it's the belief of most traditional journalists that in the long haul, that the free flow of information, this free idea of a free marketplace of ideas, is very important and is actually constructive and not destructive. So we see the lifeboat scenario just the other way around. So so it's a matter of opinion, really. Which side is right? And I think, you know, which side has the proper view of the lifeboat? You could say, like Linda Ellerbe says on her new television commercial, you decide which is right. Let me give, I'm just going to take another couple of minutes. Let me give you just a brief lesson in journalism to see why there is conflict between journalists and a lot of organizations in society, not just the LDS Church. Journalists are supposed to be watchdogs over society, and it's just does not include government, but certainly government is probably the most important role for journalists in exercising this watchdog role. However, it extends beyond government and to other institutions such as religion. Let me just read from a couple of codes that are accepted as standards in the journalism community in America. This is from the 1973 Code of Ethics for Sigma Delta Chi, Society of Professional Journalists, and probably most of the journalists you're familiar with, whether it's newspaper, television, whatever, are members of Sigma Delta Chi, or SDX as we call it. This is from the code. Freedom of the press is to be guarded as an inalienable right of people in a free society. It carries with it the freedom and the responsibility to discuss, question, and challenge actions and utterances of our government and of our public and private institutions. The Associated Press probably has the reputation, I think, of being probably the most objective among various news media. And they have a code that they adopted in 1975, and it says this. It's talking about newspapers, but certainly applies to television and radio, too. The newspaper should serve as a constructive critic of all segments of society. It should uphold, vigorously expose wrongdoing or misuse of power, public or private. And finally, this is just something I plucked out of a textbook. Nonprofit institutions is, in many cases, like dealing with government. Corporate and institutional operations also need watchdogging from the free press, and therefore an adversary relationship often exists in this area as well, speaking of non-governmental areas. This is the tradition of journalism in the United States. It's watchdog, it's check the conduct of officials, whether they're in government, whether they're in religion, private, public institutions, whatever. As long as church leaders have the view that they have about journalism and a free marketplace of ideas, and as long as journalists, or many of them, believe in these traditions, there will continue to be a conflict between institutions like the LDS Church and journalists.
I have to admit that Albert talked long and hard to get me to do this. I had a difficulty saying no. If you ever asked me to do anything else, I might be in trouble. But this afternoon, I just wrote up a brief statement, as the president says, so I'll read that. In his book, Exit, Voice, and Loyalty, Albert Hirschman describes the process by which satisfied customers make the decision to exit. In the marketplace, consumers exit when they shop around rather than buy from a particular company. Members exit political parties when they become dissatisfied with party goals or tactics. Members of religious organizations also exit, although research suggests that most people retain the religious identity of their family of origin. We still find that people exit religion either by not participating, by switching to another religious group, or by simply rejecting all forms of institutional religion. An alternative to exit, according to Hirschman, is voice. Rather than just leave, the individual has the option to, quote, kick up a fuss, unquote, thereby rectifying the dissatisfaction she feels and in turn increasing the effectiveness of the organization. Hirschman defines voice as any attempt at all to change rather than to escape from an objectionable state of affairs, whether through individual or collective petition to the management directly in charge. He says that if a person recognizes the opportunity to initiate voice and feels the prospects of change are good once voice is initiated, she will generally delay exit. Exit, therefore, becomes the choice of last resort after voice has failed. Loyal members or customers are more likely to resort to voice than to exit, even when the prospects of being heard or influencing change is relatively low. Loyalty, therefore, not only holds exit at bay, but also activates voice. Loyalty pushes women and men to discover creative new ways to exert influence and to push for a more effective organization. What does all this have to do with alternate voices? First, it should suggest that the activation of voice is actually an indication of commitment. It is the most loyal of church members who initiate voice when confronted with issues and problems related to their religion. The less committed quietly walk away. Unfortunately, the response of some church leaders is with friends like you who needs enemies. Second, it gives new meaning to the problem of intellectuals in the church. Thomas O'Day suggested in 1957 that one of the biggest problems facing the church in the next decades would be the creation of an unhappy intellectual group. However, Heaton and Albrecht have demonstrated that among Mormons, the more education is associated with higher levels of religiosity, more frequent prayer, more frequent church attendance, and stronger belief in central doctrines. So how come we have this highly vocal group that is always talking about what's wrong with Mormonism? The answer is that this group is strongly committed to what Mormonism is all about. Why is it so vocal? Because they have too much education. The intellectual label is misleading. These people are well-educated professionals. That doesn't necessarily equate to intellectual. They are used to being heard. They understand how to activate voice, the channels that are available, and how effective it can be. They have used it in their work and in their community service. and they cannot leave it home when it comes to their most beloved avocation of all, their religion. To assume that they are all, quote, on their way out of Mormonism would be incorrect. There are members of the church who are inactive. The vast majority of these inactive members retain their Mormon identity, but choose not to participate in worship services or in the ordinances of the gospel. Based on my research over the years, most of these inactive members have exited Mormonism without resorting to Voice. They leave as teenagers and young adults, and fewer than one in five leave because of problems in the church, or problems with the church. Most of these less active members are also the less educated and those of the working class. Generally less powerful in any country or organization, the option of Voice is seldom available or recognized by these people, and they therefore simply exit. There are, of course, some of these less active members who have left because of problems with the church and have left after resorting to Voice. Their pain and anger was made clear to all in the process. I have heard their pain and anger, and I must respond to them, but their experience is very much in the minority. Their defection is in no way typical. There is also a contingent of church members, most of them very well educated and very loyal, who have resorted to Voice when faced with dissatisfaction with church policy, programs, practices, and doctrine. It is often difficult to know whether these loyal church members are in the early stages of apostasy or are truly loyal members trying to influence the organization they love most. We never really know which track we're on. Applying Hirschman's theory, we can predict that these members will not exit, but will continue to resort to Voice in the face of dissatisfaction, and their use of Voice will be determined by their perception of the amount of influence that they have. Because of their loyalty, even small accommodations will be sufficient signals that the organization still deserves their loyalty. Members of this contingent are frequently pained and frustrated when their loyalties and commitments are misunderstood and are mislabeled by those who have not taken the time to understand who they are and why they do what they do. Their love of Mormonism is sometimes all-consuming. Having made commitments and sometimes suffered privately because of these commitments, they seek out forums where they can talk freely of their explorations and questions and commitments. As the church grows, the size of minority groups, such as the so-called intellectuals, also grows. Networks of members begin to form who find one another's company supportive of alternative styles of Mormonism. Population densities and economies of scale begin to provide various minority groups the resources to support a newsletter, symposium, and lectures. Concerned citizens begin to explore alternative ways to exert influence and to push for change. Some choose to activate Voice through public forums and the television and news media. Elder Oak's statement on alternative voices is not a surprise. It is what officials do as religious institutions grow up, seek greater stability, and begin to clarify official doctrines. It reminds members that they must be aware of who is saying what. It requests that we label what is said. I would gratefully appreciate it if every Sunday school teacher and every Relief Society and priesthood leader would carefully label what they said. Is it official, or is it too an alternate voice? Can we call a truce, sign a treaty, come to some sort of agreement? I doubt it, and not because I'm not eagerly seeking one. Individual pursuit of self-interest, even righteous ones, often come into conflict with organizational goals. It is just something we have to work out as we go along. In the meantime, I wonder if Elder Oaks doesn't sometimes feel he has only as much influence over the members of the church as the parent of a 3-year-old pyromaniac. For we are gathered here this evening, matches in hand.
Avail myself of the other option unless somebody says they can't hear me. tell me that you can hear me, because my remarks are not well enough prepared to warrant
the podium.
They aren't well enough prepared to warrant the voice of God either. I only found out about 3 hours ago that there were going to be prepared remarks. I expected a free-for-all with bloodshed. I understand that's merely to be postponed by these formal remarks at the beginning. I think that it's possible to completely misunderstand Elder Oakes's talk, and I think it has been done, or else I'm doing it. But after years and years of silence on the subject of what we do, we alternate voices, one of the brethren actually noticed we exist officially from the pulpit. And he did it in a way that allowed the possibility that we weren't all slime. Now, maybe I'm merely pathetically grateful for a small gesture, but I perceived his speech as a reaching out from one of the most brilliant men ever to serve on the 12, one who has, in fact, himself been an alternate voice and knows how it feels, and one who has also been in the position of tending those three-year-olds, which is much better than the figures I was going to use, so I'll steal yours. That's what you get when you're last and informal. But I think that he was talking to us particularly, because I think that most members of the church really didn't much care about this subject and still don't. He was talking to us to urge us, to encourage us in a way, by speaking to us, but also to urge us to do better and to examine ourselves. And I'm sad to realize that there are probably many, more than we've heard tonight, who have responded, instead of examining ourselves, to examining him, which seems to me to be not the correct attitude to have toward a pronouncement of someone for whom you have raised your hand to sustain him as a prophet, seer, and revelator. I think we owe him first the responsibility to do as he has asked us to do, which is to examine the alternate voices, and I suggest that we should begin with our own, which is where I began, with my wife, talking about what I do. Because heaven knows I have the hate mail to prove that there are those who think of me as definitely outside the pale. I even changed my even don't list my address in the phone book anymore for fear that someone will appear on my doorstep to follow up on some of the things that have been said. We need to ask, do I contribute to the kingdom of God? Or am I just a critic? Or worse, am I dangerous to an important cause? Have I been serving myself at the expense of the church? There are many here in this room who have probably ridiculed people who capitalize on the gospel for their personal gain by selling bumper stickers or videotapes, who nevertheless capitalize on the church in order to gain prestige, a sense of being part of a privileged elite, one that knows the inner hidden secrets of the gospel that the poor common rabble never guess. And alas, if they don't listen to us, how will they ever rise to see things as we see them, to understand the truth as we know it? We who have been to college, slept through only half our classes, and therefore are educated in the ways of the world. I'd like to suggest that there's a dividing line. It's a very wide dividing line, and it's possible to cross back and forth. I don't want to propose that we can neatly sort people into one camp or another, but I know that I can sort my activities into one kind or another. Two kinds of alternate voices. One is the critic. The critic, by definition, is always outside the community. The critic is always the one who, from a distance, is evaluating. The critic is concerned with correctness. And if the critic's words are disregarded, His attitude is, you'll see, I'm right, you'll fail. He's non-participatory. He is not committed to the success of the venture. He has no stake in the outcome. He can always take his ball and go home. But it's possible to be an alternate voice that is a counselor who is always inside, concerned with rightness, not correctness, who offers passionate advocacy, but never as an enemy. And once a decision has been reached, once the community has decided to act, supports that community while continuing to offer good counsel so that the others in the community know that his faithfulness is stronger than the bands of death. Because why should they listen to someone whose faithfulness is not that strong and who's given them no evidence of being willing to go along even if you don't do it their way? And I have found myself in both positions during my life. I suspect many of you have as well. But the point that I want to make is that the church is under no obligation to pay the slightest attention to a critic. But the church does have a heavy obligation to hear counselors. And when someone offers counsel in that role, and the church fails to hear them, then it's the church's failure and the leader's failure. Not the counselors. But when they fail to listen to a critic, it's the critic's failure. Because even if his ideas are true, he presented them in a way that they were useless to the community. Now, the root of our religion, before we had the Book of Mormon, before we had the plan of salvation, before temples, before quorums, before councils, before priesthood, before anything, is the idea that a living God can speak to a living man and deliver words to his living people. If there is anything that defines us as a people, it is that. That's the gospel that Samuel Smith carried with him when he went out the first time. That's the gospel that gathered people to organize this church. It's the thing that holds us together, if anything does. And those who undermine even naive faith in that principle of the gospel are, in fact, weakening the church. I realize that can be misinterpreted a thousand ways, but instead of answering all of the ways of misinterpreting that, I'll live with it and let myself be crucified by those who like to niggle at words. Because I do believe it. The Mormon Church, if it is anything, is the community formed by those who are committed to living by the Word of God, delivered prophetically. And the Word of God to the church is delivered through the prophets. The Word of God to individuals is delivered to individuals. Some people have a problem telling the difference. Let me propose some voices to you and see what you think they'd be. Take a Mormon who has become a born-again Christian, left the church, but he returns to speak to us, to teach us of the superior knowledge that he's received. He's rediscovered the Bible. He's found out what it really means. He's felt this burning. And he wants to come back to us, not to punish us, not because he hates us, not because he's an enemy, but because he realizes in his heart that Mormons are misguided, that they need to be taught and helped to understand the truth. His purpose is entirely compassionate. He is a true Christian. Nevertheless, would you consider him a legitimate voice within the church? Or a critic from outside? There may be some disagreement on that. I think, for me at least, the answer is pretty clear. He's a benevolent outsider, a well-meaning critic, but an outsider and a critic nonetheless. He denies the premise of our community. He may have some truth, and we should receive that truth gladly. We should allow him to reawaken us to our responsibilities as Christians. But we cannot trust his information to be true in the way that we've agreed to accept truth. Or take another one, fundamentalist. A Mormon who has been reading the statements of early prophets, always a dangerous thing to do. But fortunately, it's avoided by most members of the church. But he's been reading those statements, and because of a misguided belief that every word that drips from the mouth of anyone who has ever held a high office in the church must be pure revelation, he is sure that the church should never have abandoned such wonderful practices as polygamy, because it's through that refiner's fire that the church was created and strengthened. And we in this modern generation are obviously a soft, weak, spineless bunch without anything near the strength that our forebears had. And so he returns to living those laws and sincerely believes that he will save us if he can only persuade us to do the same. An alternate voice? Any of you have any latent sympathy for the folks who gather together in communes with seven women for every man? Why not? Sincere. They're sincere. Heaven knows they're laying their very lives on the line with this. But yet you don't accord them any serious credence at all. Why? You may have your own reasons. But one of the reasons I don't is that I cannot deal with those who prefer dead prophets to living ones. So now take the case of many of us who are intellectual or liberal Mormons, however you want to define us. Often, too often, we trust science or history or the principle of literary criticism, anything more than we trust the prophets. We measure their words very carefully against what we've learned in our studies. The prophet attacks the idea of homosexuality and we answer, but the facts show, forgetting that the facts showed something very different as recently as 10 years ago, that science too has its fads. We test the prophet's words against the world, and when they don't match, we reject the prophet. And now tell me, how are such people any more alternate voices within the church than the fundamentalists or than a born-again Christian who has left the church? Merely because they allow some revelation, wherever it doesn't happen to contradict their pet doctrines from the world, such people think they are still inside the church, but they are wrong. They have placed their faith in something else. Their highest allegiance is to another community. They can't be trusted any more than we would trust that fundamentalist or that born-again Christian to deliver us truth. I wrote a note here of something I wanted to talk about, and I think I'm going to skip it. It gets too personal. No, I'm not going to skip it. Because as long as I'm rambling, why not? Recent Sunstone had a testament from a man that I have loved for many years and admired as the epitome of course, I didn't use this word, of what an alternate voice should be. I was well aware that his set of beliefs was extremely different from mine, that we differed on points of doctrine so fundamental that I thought, how can anyone be different, not believe this, and still be a Mormon? But I knew that his commitment was not wavering from his behavior, and I began to realize how narrow a band of doctrine it is that we depend on to bind us together. I admired his humility and his patience. I never saw him on attack. I saw him wronged and maligned and never answer. I watched him work with other people to try to speak to the general membership of the church. But then apparently he either lost patience or perhaps hope or perhaps the last shred of faith. Because when 3 days ago I read the article that he wrote, it broke my heart to see him publicly confess a Platonic faith. the faith founded in the learning of the world. Because he was a man with the wit to know what was going on. And I still can't make sense of the fact that he didn't understand the implications of his own position, that he could never apply to his own case the scriptures that talk about how the truth of the Lord will be delivered from the weak and simple people of the world and not from the vain learning of the world. And with that confession, he became a critic, where he had been an insider until that time. He has confessed another faith and held it up as superior, and in effect ceased to be a counselor. It doesn't diminish my love for him or my respect for him. In fact, I admire his courage. Nor am I surprised by any of the beliefs he confesses. I knew he felt that way all along. What hurts my feelings, what makes me sad, is that he has ceased to hold all of that in abeyance and has come down and declared his faith in the learning of the world. As long as he didn't commit to that, he was still inside. But when he did, he was out in terms of the ability to speak as a counselor. I'm not talking about membership in the church. That's a formal issue, and thank heaven the church doesn't go hounding people for their beliefs. Hope they never do. There were two letters in that same issue from homosexuals. Their letters were couched in pious tones, used pretty phrases about the loving God that they believed in, and how beautiful their loving relationship with another man was. And I listened, I read, thinking that I've had many loving relationships with men and women, but somehow never felt that gave me a right to sodomize them. These homosexuals implicitly deny the prophet's right to call it a sin to hold them to the same standard of chastity expected of unmarried LDS teenagers, of widows and widowers in the church. And so they offered their testament of a religion founded in lust, justified by the fashionable doctrines of the world. Justification of sin by appeal to the world. If it feels good, do it. And again, in reading that, I can see what I think Elder Oaks is warning us against. How easy it is to find excuses to have our personal desires, our favorite ideas, held superior to the doctrines of the and teachings of the prophets. Compared to the work of the church, these intellectual pursuits are marginal. I love them. I enjoy every single one of these games we play. But it is nothing compared to the importance of trying to acquire the strength to resist temptation. Trying to acquire the courage to overcome our fear to act. Of trying to develop the commitment to serve others. The struggle to love and understand our neighbor. The basics. We aren't doing them. At least I'm not. Maybe you are. I've only known a few people in my life who really do. And it's an amazing thing. One of them. One. Was an intellectual. Means to be a follower of Christ are not by any stretch of the imagination intellectuals. Some haven't finished high school. Some working in jobs that you would despise. But they're good. And they know something that you'll never find in a class. And what they know is true. And what you know from the class is merely neat and exciting and fun. And sometimes true. But these people are dependably true. And when every now and then I catch myself acting like them, I also discover that that's when I actually feel most joyful and feel most certain of the truthfulness of the gospel. Now, this sounds like I'm giving you a Sunday school lesson. That's what I'm doing, and I'm doing it too long. But Elder Oaks was right. We can get distracted. We can start thinking that the stuff we talk about in places like this is the most important stuff in the world, and it isn't. It just isn't. The most important stuff in the world is what goes on between us and the other people we deal with in our lives. Even the ones with incorrect opinions, even the ones with unsophisticated ideas, even the ones who have not yet achieved our enlightened understanding of how the world works. And yet, this doesn't mean that I'm quitting my job as a writer. It doesn't mean that I'm going to stop being an alternate voice. I'm going to continue doing it, and not just because it's finally actually paying me a decent wage. I was doing it back when it didn't. So I will continue to write as I do, despite the hate mail from volunteer members who like to enforce the idea of correctness in the church. And I'll do it in spite of the anonymous letters that are sent to general authorities and the embarrassment of being called in every now and then when an area president comes to my stake and asked about the highlighted portions of a Xeroxed page from one of my books. Which I try to bear patiently, though my wife knows that there are long conversations far into the night in which I carry on my side of fervent arguments, in which I eviscerate all of the pinheads of the universe. But the fact is that the more visible we become, the more we speak, the more power we have to influence other saints. And I'd rather be silent than lead someone away. Because my silence is a small sacrifice that I could voluntarily produce compared to deceiving or misleading someone else. The answer to this is not to be silent, but the answer is to be a counselor, not a critic. To always be an insider, even if you have to fake it to start with. It's okay to fake being good, okay? That sounds like I'm advocating hypocrisy, but I'm not. If you fake it by living it every minute of your life, pretty soon you find out that's what being good is. It's only when you try to fake it while actually being evil. Before we have a right to expect the church to listen to us, they have to know that our loyalty is unshakable. If you don't establish your sincere loyalty, you won't be heard. So even if you're being practical and cynical about it, you have to do that. But I believe we can use our voices as much to encourage the good as to counsel for change. Can I tell a story?
Briefly?
No, I'll just wait and spring it later. I'll do a short one now. A fellow came into our ward from outside, brand new guy. I'd been there for about 5 years. He was new. He was in there for about 3 weeks, and he was asked to teach the priesthood meeting on Fast Sundays when both quorums gathered together. And he ended his lecture on the importance of home teaching, supported by more scriptures than I actually thought there were, by saying, "Brethren, the Spirit of the Lord may visit here, but it doesn't dwell here." To which I thought, what right do you have to say that? You don't know these people. You're wrong. I know these people, and the Spirit of the Lord does dwell here. But I didn't answer. For one thing, the meeting was over, and people get impatient and testy when you go on too long. But there's this bit about patience and long-suffering, which is true. Because about 6 months later, I got called to give the talk at Christmas. You'll be amazed what you can do with a Christmas sermon. Boy, it can cover anything you want it to. But I ended up, briefly, ending my talk with the words, "The Spirit of the Lord doesn't just visit here, it dwells here." But only after I had told the stories of 7 or 8 examples of people who lived the gospel of Jesus Christ. If you wait, if you're patient, if you're long-suffering, if you're meek, if you're willing to follow, if you're willing to obey, you will eventually be heard. If you speak in anger, in haste, loudly, critically, you'll be heard, but your words will be wasted. And it'll be harder for you to be heeded the next time you speak. It's as simple as that. That's what Elder Oaks, I think, was trying to tell us. If we listen to him, we can actually contribute to the kingdom of God. If we don't, we can't. Not because they're going to send a goon squad out to shut us up, but because if we don't do as he suggested, nobody's going to listen, except for other people like us. We're going to be preaching to the choir. Well, in our church, that doesn't really count. I just want you to know that I get just as mad as you do, as any of you do, as you do. I get just as mad as... No, I don't get just as mad as Levina does. I don't. But I get pretty mad. And I don't always act wisely, so you hear me speaking all these things about what I think we should do, but you won't always see me acting that way. But I try. And I think it's worthwhile, and I think that Elder Oaks was doing us a favor, and now I'll shut up and let it go on.
Is this on? Can you hear me? No?
They can hear me.
Oh, good.
This is a worthiness test.
Okay. I think they can hear me now. First, I want to give the opportunity to any of the panelists to respond to anything any of the other panelists said. And after that, we can go to questions. But first, Luann, did you have any other comments?
Yes, I have a comment. We heard a lecture on journalistic ethics. We got some wonderful sociological background. We got a Sunday school lesson. As nearly as I could tell, I'm the only one who read the talk. Or listened to it. He did not say what you said he said, Scott. Maybe you wish he'd said it, but that's not what he said. That wasn't what he was talking about. And Lynn, what did you have to say have to do with what Elder Oaks said? And of course I agree with Marie, but I wish she'd pushed a little further.
Wait.
Let's give Lynn a chance first.
No.
Yes.
I thought you said it was free for all.
I know, but Scott.
That was an outrageous thing to say from someone who spent her entire talk picking at every single word and trying to find ways to redefine it until you could find it wrong. I read his talk. You rewrote it.
Okay, Lynn? Murray?
Doesn't reach. For you to say that I didn't read the talk makes me feel kind of bad, Levina.
Because I
did read the talk, and maybe my comments were a little obtuse, but that's because I'm a sociologist. We're trained to be that way. I think we really need to... there's a place for dissecting talks, and there's also a place for seeing it in the broader context. And like I said, I'm not surprised by the talk. At some point, you're going to have talks, and we'll always have talks like that. I think I'm more interested in analyzing what we're doing and why we do what we do. I think there's a very fine line between a counselor who judges the actions of others without adequate information and a critic who judges the actions of others based on stereotypes. And so I'm a little concerned about the way I think Scott said some of the things he said. I think the place I'm coming from this is that I really would like to somehow build a community in which the diversity that's not represented in this audience can be appreciated, where we can come together and enjoy our friendships and have our great conversations and enjoy the opportunity to do that and not have to put down one person or another in the process.
I have a question for Lynn. The Channel 2 news spots that they give to hype the journalists, they say, you know, we're part of this community and we just don't report the news, but we care because we live here too. You give a strong defense for the forthright, you know, just the facts, here's the truth. But do journalists have a responsibility as a part of a community? And I particularly want an application to Mormons who are trying to just be, you know, totally honest in their research and in their studies. And are there limits?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, traditional journalists believe that they are helping build and improve the community by telling the news, saying what's going on, even though some of the stories are unpleasant and in the short term can be destructive or damaging. Utah journalists, I'm sure it's true in some other parts of the United States, but generally do not practice traditional journalism when it comes to the church. There's generally a hands-off attitude in covering LDS church stories. And I think part of it is because they, I don't think it's so much out of respect for community as respect for money, is that really, because Channel 2 has always been trying to beat Channel 5 in the ratings. And I'm privy to some of the discussions that they've had inside their news organization about covering negative church stories. And they know that if they're seen as being the anti-Mormon station, it can cost them a lot of viewers and subsequently cost them a lot of money. And I think it's a case sometimes where you literally choose between profits and exercising the money profits, or between profits and profits. All right.
Okay, any other comments from the panel? Okay, let's take the next half hour for questions from the audience. Now, I was at a recent MHA conference where Jan Schiff tried to the audience, who members of the audience, who stand up to give a question and give sermons. And she threatened to cut them off. And I will do the same. So we don't want anyone to stand up and give another talk. We want questions for this panel.
Well, it will be nice to hear you cut someone off. You know. I want to say that as the more Scott Card talked, the more I came to agree with him, and I realized that there are people here who would want to crucify you. I realize that. It might do you more honor than you should get, but I... The problem that I have, and I'm going to state it first as a declarative sentence and then as an interrogatory, is that you make a distinction between counselors and critics. The only difference that I can see is that counselors are called by the power structure and critics have been rejected by the power structure. And the reason why critics don't get called as counselors is because they're critical. And what you have to lay aside your critical aspect in order to be allowed into the structure. The reason is not usually, as you have pointed out, because of the substance of your criticism, because usually we never get to that. But it has to do with maybe your tone. You stated, you know, if your tone is angry or if you're upset or if you're too strident or if you quote too many scriptures or you're more too intellectual or you come on too strong, you're not going to be seen as a counselor. You're going to be seen as a second-class citizen. But the problem there, I think, has to do not so much, and I want to know whether you agree, so much with whether a person's a critic or not, but whether the establishment can accept voices that don't shape their comments in a way that's going to be acceptable to the tradition in the power structure. I mean, isn't it also a function of charity to allow a critic to come in, accept him, listen carefully to what he says, and accept him as if he were a counselor, because you may be the voice of God coming through a different source than we expect, just to challenge us and get us to repent.
Would we were all so wise that we could hear people that way. It would be very nice if we all had that level of patience. But we don't. It's not the tone, it's the substance, though the tone can interfere. But it strikes me that only an idiot would walk into a situation where he wanted to influence and go on the attack. Of course, I just did that. But then again, I don't, you know, expect you to believe me because I'm neat and cool and wonderful. I expect you to believe me because what I say is true. And when it's not true, I hope you don't believe me. But I wasn't talking about counselors who were only called to be counselors. Maybe it's unfortunate I used a word that is a church office as well. But I've known many, many people to be counselors who have no such calling, but they offer it as counsel. And if you're humble enough to offer it as counsel, you're likely to be heard. If you're arrogant enough that you have to pose as a critic and someone with superior understanding, you'll be treated as someone who's arrogant and considers himself superior. You won't be heard. So in that sense, it's tone. You're right. But at the same time, I see no virtue in that. I see only ineffectiveness and often a self-serving desire to be seen as wiser than others without ever having to be part of building something. Maybe, you know.
Since this is being recorded, we need you to come up to the microphone. And it's hard for the rest of the audience to hear when you speak from your seat.
I just have a short question. Would you consider Ether, Moroni, and Samuel the Lamanite to be critics or counselors?
Are you seriously want an answer to that? They're prophets. Meaning
okay.
They're speaking the words of God, fulfilling assignments given to them by God. If you don't believe that, why are you here?
Okay,
I have a question. First of all, I want to just say that this is really exciting for me because I've found it very enlightening. I don't consider myself an intellectual, although the people in my priesthood quorum think I'm the token intellectual. To me, an intellectual is someone who has wisdom. I have a little bit of knowledge and I'm constantly gaining more, but I don't think I have wisdom yet. Now, my question is, the first thing that I thought of when I heard Elder Oaks' speech, because when I got done, and maybe this is a sign of not being an intellectual, I thought, what is he saying? And I talked with a number of people, and their question was, what is he saying? We couldn't figure it out. I read his speech in the Ensign, and I still couldn't figure it out. And after listening to all of you, I still can't figure it out. My question is, has anyone contacted Elder Oaks? Has anyone written to him? Has anyone called him? And this is not only to the panel, but to anyone. Has anyone asked him, what did you mean with that talk? Because I don't know, and I really would like to know. That's my question. If anyone has an answer, please. You know.
Well, as Elder Oaks made the point, they don't speak officially at such occasions as this.
Can I offer? I mean, it's not. I'm not doing what you asked. But when I was asked to do the rewrite on the Hill Cumorah pageant, I sat in Elder Oaks' office long before this speech was given, and he talked about the process they went through to deem me acceptable, and he pointed out that I think his words were, you've written some things that have set some people's teeth on edge, which is a kind way of putting it. But he said, I read it myself, and I think that you're acceptable. Now, maybe you don't like being judged that way, but I didn't think that he was judging whether I was acceptable as a human being before God. He was judging whether I was an acceptable person to write a document that would be perceived as officially the voice of the church, which is an entirely different question. But he also showed himself to be open, and the book that I'm sure he was referring to was Saint Speak. I have no evidence that any general authority had ever heard of or read any of my other work but that, which is a book that, since then I've had evidence, but at that time I hadn't. And I think that that bespeaks an attitude on his part, and maybe that's what I was interpreting this talk through, that I saw him as a very tolerant and open man who was willing to not judge something just because someone had told him it was offensive.
I think that Maria is right that a talk like Elder Oaks is not a surprise. I think that the reaction to it is one that strikes me as being surprised sometimes. But I think that the reactions on, I think Levina's reaction is appropriate to analyze very carefully what was said. I also think that Scott's approach was also appropriate, but I think he's wrong. And my question is to Scott, do you really believe that there is no point at which one's own integrity, not stemming from study or some kind of intellectual abstraction, but from a real personal commitment, which must be measured carefully to make sure you're not just following a fad or something comfortable, but that really you feel in your heart to be the case, that such a feeling could never take you to a point where you would question loyalty to an institution that said things that just did not sit right with you?
How could I possibly deny that? There are thousands of people who reach that point in many different communities all the time, and they leave the community.
May I follow up then? You're right. If you say that one's loyalty must, and you have to decide where your loyalty sits, but I am confused by a loyalty to an institution that makes pronouncements such as this and such as others of even stronger quality. There is some kind of balance that must be struck, and it just doesn't seem to me to be as clear as the one that you make between being a critic or a counselor.
If you think that
I thought
I laid the rules down, that I knew that it wasn't clear and that we move back and forth and it's a difficult line, but no, it's not clear-cut. It's very hard. It's painful, and the whole process is excruciating at times. I'm not denying that. Nor am I trying to judge anybody else. I'm really trying to judge my own motives and what I'm doing, but the church is not the Elks Club. It's your whole life, or it isn't.
Okay, next question.
When Scott Card moved from Utah, a light went out. And though we have not communicated for a long time, as I was preparing my confession of a cultural Mormon, I thought of no one more than Scott Card and what his reaction would be. I am sorry that my paper has caused him pain. His comments tonight have created for me only joy to know that despite our disagreements, his love is stronger than his distinctions between critics and counselors. And for me, that's what the gospel is about.
Question for Sister Anderson. When I was listening to Elder Oaks talk, when he was talking about leaders not taking official stands or being on debates or so on, what the picture I had in mind was not general authorities, but local bishops or stake presidents being invited to participate, say, in a debate with an anti-Mormon or something, since anti-Mormons have been active so recently, and I've heard of cases like on something like the John Ankerberg show or something having free state presidents.
I'm sorry, I can't understand you sitting right here. You're talking so fast.
I'm talking too fast. I'm sorry.
I've lived in the South too long.
I did want to. My apologies. When Elder Oaks was talking about that, what I thought he was talking about was, say, sponsoring a debate with some anti-Mormons from local bishops or stake presidents. I've heard of cases of something like three stake presidents on the John Ankerberg show or something like that, and and really getting flubbed up or something. I thought they were saying they didn't want the local church leaders to be involved in such public debates with enemies of the church, which usually weren't very fruitful. That's what I had in mind, and not that they were limiting that thing to general authorities. I don't know if this is really a question, but do you have more information from your experience as an editor of the Ensign, which would lead you to that interpretation, is that he was limiting it to a general authority, or as opposed to bishops and stake presidents and so on?
The only thing that I had to go on was the text, which was equally available to all of us.
Uh-huh.
And it seemed to me to be quite clear from the context of those four particular paragraphs that he was not talking about local leaders. As you will recall, he had a paragraph to introduce that particular section where he talked about local leaders screening the content of classes. And this came after he talked about how on the general level there's a screening so that you can listen to what comes from the official level with confidence that you're not being misled. Then he followed that with the four paragraphs in which he talked about church leaders are sometimes invited to appear on debates and symposia to present the position of the church on a policy or a doctrine or a program. And that's the place in which he used church leader or representative of the church five times and member or volunteer five times. And I did spend quite a lot of time reading and rereading that in the context of the whole talk and separately, and it seemed to me that he was saying a church leader in that context is a general authority and everybody else is a member and a volunteer and not an appreciated volunteer either.
I guess I'll have to go reread that and see if I agree. I just had a different perspective when I was...
Well, I think that it's possible that possible to read it some other way.
For what it's worth, close reading of texts often gets you a collection of meaningless phrases. I heard the talk, and I was not left with anything like that impression. And so if you want to take somebody and hang him for a word and say, he seems to have said that either you're a general authority or a common member who has no right to speak, you can do that. I think his life is a testament to the fact that he doesn't believe that for a second, and it's nonsense to try to take his text and twist it into something like that. It's a perversion of the critical art.
Is it possible that you are saying something that I didn't say as though I had said it?
I think you just said it. I listened to the process of analysis you just went through, and it sounds to me like a way to extract meaninglessness from a meaningful phrase and paragraph and speech.
Okay, so basically you're accusing me of making Dallin Oaks an offender for a word. Is that correct?
Precisely.
Okay. You're entitled to your opinion.
Scott, I enjoyed your talk until you got to one point. And then you...
Was that the third or fourth word?
Kind of lost me. It seems like that the general answer that I receive and that I hear other people receiving whenever they question anything that's going on in the church today is follow the living prophet. And that's supposed to be the answer to all. And as I read Sunstone and Dialogue and attend these conferences and so on, I've asked myself, now, really, what are they doing? What is the purpose there? And I've answered myself saying, what these people are doing, and I'm not one of the intellects, you know, what these people are doing are reading the scriptures back in the early Joseph Smith and Brigham Young days of the basic philosophies of the church and looking at what's being taught today by the church as their basic philosophies. And there seems to be a wide divergence in several of those considerations. To become a god in the celestial kingdom, at one time you have to practice polygamy, and then a few years later, you don't have to practice polygamy to become a god in the celestial kingdom. Now that isn't a matter of following the current prophet. That's a matter of, is the truth there or is it not, and which are you going to accept? So when you said, your answer is follow the living prophet, and yet the living prophet tells us to read about the old prophets. Now, am I to read about the old prophets or to follow the living prophets, and which am I to take as the word? I don't understand what you're saying, Scott.
You people who are laughing, do you really take this question seriously?
Yes.
It's not the group I thought I was talking to. Yeah, I'm sorry, that's right, boo. But But think a minute about what's being asked. Isn't it possible to hold some things in abeyance? Isn't it possible to conceive of a world in which you're instructed to do one thing at one time and another at another?
Sure.
Don't you do that to your children? Don't you do that to your children? Isn't this just strikes me as being obvious.
I don't have an answer, and for one of the reasons, because I don't spend a lot of time reading old or new prophets, I guess. The ambiguities aren't present, but I think one of the things that we need to give some credence to is that religious institutions do change, and that all things are not knowable, and that's one of the processes of faith. That you, in Mormonism we teach that faith is a knowledge of all things, you know, whatever that thing is, past, present, and future. But it...
It's certainly not going to Scripture.
I mean, speaking of the world's picked up on that. They've got that new TV show, Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. I mean, it's sort of that, trying to deal with that whole thing. But I think we give too much emphasis to that notion that we can know all truth and we can figure everything out at once. I think we can learn a lot from the simple people of the world who have faith. And I would like to do that sometime. I'm having difficulty right now on that subject. What we're really talking about is having a core commitment to something that really guides and directs our lives. And I think for every person, that something, even within Mormonism, is slightly different. And we have to live with that ambiguity.
Okay. I'm going to end this addressing to a different person than I started. As I was listening to Mr. Card, I was noticed thinking back to growing up in Orange County, California, and everyone had the bumper stickers, America, love it or leave it. And the implicit thing was either accept it all the way and don't question or get out of here. And we're told, listen to the living prophets and do what they do. But as I listened to everybody talking about what was said at the conference, I realize Elder Oaks is not a prophet. We're so confused on this. How do we know what the message of the living prophets are? I did question one of Benson's talks and was told that was merely advice. And other people interpret it as being prophecy. The last question, though, comes from someone who I have questioned before. And I want to address it to Marie Cornwall as a sociologist. And this is, I'm bringing it back to a woman's issue for me, would be... You know, you talk about counselors, and you said that was not a direct thing. But is it possible when we address what we're saying as women, and I question this, do you find this, are we often viewed as critics if we question because we're not allowed to be counselors? And that's a question I have.
I have a problem... First off, with the dichotomy of critic and counselor, sociologists learned long ago that dichotomies are only heuristic and don't really help us with the world. If you're talking about the frustration that women feel in the church these days because they seem to have a lack of influence and a lack of input, yes, I think that, I don't know what you want me to say, but yes, that is a problem and we need to address it. And we need to talk about it. But I don't know how to respond to that in terms of critic, counselor sort of notions, because that just puts us on two sides of the fence.
I wanted to change the subject a little bit, since if we get started on women's issues, it will be a long and interesting road. One of the most interesting articles that we printed during the time that I was at the Ensign was Gene England's essay on speaking the truth in love, and he had talked about the problems for members of speaking to each other and telling true things, but doing it in a loving way that will build community,
rather than destroy community. And I'm sorry for the tone of anger that has come into our discussion tonight. I don't feel angry. I don't feel angry about Elder Oaks. May have a moment or two of irritation at Scott, but I'm sorry about that tone of irritation too, because I think that we all need more practice, not less, in community building. And I think that ideally, if I were making a wish list, that what I would wish is that there were a way to talk and to listen together rather than some people doing most of the talking all the time and all of the listening at other times. And I feel that it's a lack in our community that we don't have a very active tradition of dissent, and we have very underdeveloped forms of feedback from grassroots up, and such limited forums from the top down. There's General Conference, there's occasionally state conferences, but their general authorities attend those so seldom return to the same stake more than once or twice in their lifetimes anymore. And the BYU devotionals have developed into a kind of ad hoc forum for general authorities to say things that they think need to be said, but don't somehow need to be said in general conference. But it's quite obvious that much of what those BYU undergraduates are sitting there listening to is not aimed at them. And so there's a kind of indirectness. We speak at each other sometimes through the newspaper instead of face-to-face. We participate in forums like this, and paragraphs and snippets get published and someone underlines them and sends them to somebody else. And I think that's unfortunate. I wish that, and I hope, and I trust that we'll develop ways to develop forums and ways and a trusting community where we can share what we believe is the truth, and that we can do it in ways that our motives of love will not be questioned, and neither will our motives of loyalty.
As I was listening, something triggered in my mind a difference in attitude toward diversity of thought and conformity from the beginning days of the church to now. I read recently where the saints would meet, I can't remember where I read it, but it was like 18 hours they met, and each one of them had a half an hour to expound their theories and their beliefs, and they met, I think, on six subsequent nights for 3 hours. And what a wonderful, rich outpouring of ideas to one another. Whereas now it appears to me that what Scott was trying to say was be quiet and listen and not be taught by one another. And I think that's the problem. I'd like you to discuss that.
Right. And he certainly has a problem doing that. Being a little flip, Scott.
I came here tonight deliberately as a dissenter. You know how dissenters are received in a community that thinks it knows the truth. And that's the pose that was needed. It's been here, but at no point did I talk about blind faith or not questioning. I've lived a life of questioning. I don't take anything that somebody says on blind faith without examining it myself. I just suggest that it's possible to offer your criticism as counsel. It's possible. I've seen it done many, many times, even by women, even by people who are not considered, even by women, meaning that we were just hearing about how difficult it is and women are never called as counselors, which is nonsense. My wife's a counselor, or was counselor until she was released recently. That official calling is offered to women in presidencies in the church. We're all, it's possible to be counselors. And to do that, you have to be thinking, you have to be questioning, you have to recognize that there's something wrong with the way things are. There's certainly something wrong with the way things are. There's many, many things wrong with the way things are. Also, we don't know everything yet. I don't know how you could take what I said and think that I'm talking about blind faith or listening and not talking.
I just want to clarify. I did not say that women did not function.
I think it was someone asking you a
question, too. And in support, perhaps, of what you're saying, I should be the last person to say that women never counsel in the church, given my experience. But I have also had the opposite experience, and I don't want to deny that we've got to resolve that problem.
And I don't deny that either. It is a problem. It's a problem when anybody's shut out of an opportunity to speak and be heard.
We have five more minutes, and so let's take these two questions. I'm sorry, ma'am. We have to...
Okay. I'd like to direct my question towards Lynn. You defined your role, or the role of journalists as watchdogs that provide information from the official sources and alternative sources, and even praise the AP for the work that they've done in that area. But I'd like to just get your personal opinion. I'd like to get a little personal feeling from you tonight, not just, you know, generic information about journalism, but how do you feel personally? Does your department at BYU and does on-campus journalism at BYU perform this function as watchdogs? And and basically, I guess the question would be, do alternative voices get heard at BYU through on-campus sources?
I think, unfortunately, there's not a lot of reporting of alternate voices at BYU. The Daily Universe is the primary news outlet on campus, and I teach some students who go on to report for the Daily Universe. And also KBYU Television has a statewide broadcast, but they deal more in off-campus news, state and city news. It's one of the problems at BYU. I gave a speech at BYU about five, six, 7 years ago, and the title of it was Mormon Morality Versus Journalism Ethics. And in that speech, I talked about the problem that Mormon journalists have, because sometimes journalistic ethics and ideals conflict sharply with Mormon goals and ideals, and this watchdog idea is one of them. And I think that's one of the reasons that a lot of reporters who get experience at the Daily Universe are not well respected in the traditional journalistic community, because they've dealt probably more with what you'd call propaganda than news. And it's unfortunate. And it's something that the department talks about. And there's even some question that has kind of filtered down from the church office building about whether BYU should even be teaching journalism. And the reason is because you're teaching people to go out and be watchdogs, and not just attack Mormons, but to attack politicians. When I say Mormon authorities are anti-media, it's just not that they're talking about their own ox being gored. They don't like to see stories like against Jimmy Swaggart and some of those.
Can I make one more question? How strongly has the department at BYU gotten behind, say, for example, off-campus or such as the Student Review? Has there been a lot of support from the professors on campus who are journalists, supposedly, for sources such as that provide alternate voices?
Mm-hmm. There's been nothing come down from the department for or against. I give my students in the basic journalism class extra credit if they're published, and I give them the same extra credit if they're published in the off-campus journals as if they're published in the Daily Universe. And I've had students get published both ways.
Scott, you characterized the intellectuals' activity as mostly fun, games, sort of a trivial characterization there. I would like to suggest that there is maybe another kind of intellectual activity. Personally, I'm very interested in theological questions. I try to study them in depth and seriously. My experience in the church is that, although I'm a faithful member and have, as my husband says, disguised myself as the mother of eight and a primary teacher,
very convincing.
I do wish to write and share the ideas and insights that I have. My first article I wrote and sent to Ensign, hoping that since I made it as simple as I could, that they would publish it. It was rejected. Levine, in fact, was the one who rejected it. I sent the same article to Sunstone, and they immediately published it. My point is, I don't think that the official church gives serious intellectuals a forum for expressing their ideas, even as counselors. Can
absolutely.
You address that?
You're absolutely right. For when you're talking about theological ideas, the only forum that exists is the pathetic one in the College of Religion at BYU and the seminaries and institutes, in which it seems that the main point is to collate all of the statements of dead general authorities and try to make them fit. Fortunately, since this can't be done, they'll never reach a conclusion. But there is no... there seems to be, to me also, no place for serious theological discussion.
So I say thank God for Sunstone, who,
so do I.
Who has consented
so do I.
to publish a few of my articles.
I'll make this brief. Scott, the words critic and criticism seem to be dirty words to you, although during the last few minutes you seem to have blurred that slightly.
I didn't hear the last thing you said. Sorry.
The last few minutes you seem to have blurred your distinction in terms of totally dismissing the positive value of critics or criticism. The lady who asked whether the prophets she mentioned from the Book of Mormon were critics or were counselors, which you immediately responded to in the tone, are you serious about that? And you seem to dismiss her seriousness. Why should any of us, including prophets, have to check our critical faculties at the door? I don't quite understand your narrow definition of criticism. I could speculate on your aversion to critics, but I'd rather hear it from you.
Well, since I am a critic, partly by profession, write a regular column of criticism and have devoted many hours of my life to criticism, I obviously don't disdain it as an enterprise. In fact, I'm here as a critic.
By what you said tonight, that doesn't seem to be...
No. As a matter of fact, I was talking about the ineffectiveness of it. In fact, what you picked up, the tone of arrogance... the superior pose, the sneering at someone's question, is something that's very familiar, should be familiar to many people here. This is what we're perceived as.
I did not mention the tone of arrogance.
No. I know. I'm taking that. That's exactly what I was doing. Was a tone of arrogance. Someone asks a simple question, and they're treated with disdain. That's what you ask, and it's very painful to watch, I hope, and embarrassing, and makes that person feel angry and hurt. I was acting as a critic and attacking the questioner.
You see criticism as equaling arrogance?
No. Well, see, I was taking two words, counselor and critic, which have certain meanings already, whole field of meanings. I'm not trying to say that that's what they always mean. I was trying to use those as convenient labels for two ways of approaching questions in the church, two ways of approaching problems with doctrines and ideas.
Okay. Thank you for coming this evening. Let's give an applause for her.
Wait.
We have a final musical number and a concluding prayer. While our people are setting up the microphones for that, I'd like to just read the statement of purpose that we have at the front of our program. I think it applies to some of the discussions here tonight, and it's something I have come to feel strongly about in my years as working with Sunstone. It reads, "This symposium is dedicated to the idea that the truths of the gospel of Jesus Christ are better understood and as a result better lived when they are freely and frankly discussed within the community of saints." That sentence was first crafted when I helped organize the first symposium in Washington, D.C. And I really have come to believe that they need to be openly and freely discussed within the community. And it goes on, "We recognize that the search for things that are, have been, and are to be," thank you, Marie, is a sifting process in which much chaff will have to be inspected and threshed before wheat can be harvested. In sponsoring this symposium, we welcome the honest ponderings of Latter-day Saints and their friends, and expect that everyone will approach all issues, no matter how difficult, with intelligence and goodwill. I have been most impressed in my heart tonight by the emphasis that we must address all of our issues with charity. I think every one of our people has spoken on that tonight. And I hope that topic and the tone of charity will pervade all our discussions throughout the remaining 3 days of the symposium. We'll have a concluding performance by Elaine Thatcher, and is Kathy with you? And Kathy Boswell, and Lou Wallace, good friend of mine. We'll give our benediction. Thank you.